Discover AI with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Savine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the 47th episode of Robots. Today, we stray into the realm of artificial intelligence, what it means, its early beginnings, and where it may be going in the future. We speak with Kristin R. Thorsson from the Reykjavik University in Iceland, who's been involved in the AI scene for the last 20 years. He tells us about some of the great advances, but also some of the disappointments in the field, and where he thinks AI will be used in the near future.
We then speak with Wendelin Reich, who is Associate Professor in Social Psychology from Uppsala, Sweden. He'll be giving us his excellent definition of a robot. But first, let's hear the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. U.S. magazine Popular Science has partnered with Google to scan and publish 137 years of its publications. Among some robotics goodies uncovered is an article on robot sentries from 1985, an article entitled Teachable Robot Can Remember 200 Commands from 1962, and the disclosure of a secret robotic navigator for a military jeep based on using an autograph from 1944. Researchers at the University of Tokyo's JSK Robotics Laboratory have created an anthropomimetic robot. The humanoid called Kojiro uses cables attached to specific locations on the body, simulating how human muscles and tendons contract and relax with the goal of making the robot lighter and more agile. Unlike previous anthropomimetic robots, Kojiro also has a flexible spine and incorporates about 100 muscles, resulting in some 60 degrees of freedom. With its hardware nearing completion, the researchers now focus on developing suitable control algorithms for its non-linear dynamics using an iterative learning process. An open-source project has equipped a Roomba with an onboard web server and camera to create a real-world Googlebot. The Googlebot, written with a double Swedish semiligature A instead of a double O, is a play on the Swedish word gu, similarly spelled with a Swedish semiligature A, which means to go, and the name of Google's indexing software Googlebot, spelled, well, you know how. The resulting Going Indexer robot uses its camera in combination with OCR text recognition software to create a search index of your apartment while vacuuming. For more information on 137 years of robotics publication, Japan's new anthropomimetic robot, and the Swedish Googlebot, visit our forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Kristin R. Thorsson is assistant professor at the School of Computer Science at the Reykjavik University in Iceland. Active in the AI scene for the last 20 years, Thorsson has founded several companies specializing in AI, as well as two separate AI labs in Iceland. Thorsson leads us on a guided tour of AI since its inception in the 50s, through ages of promise and darkness to where it's at right now. He also talks about his own research into constructivist AI and where he hopes to see AI in the future.
Hi, Chris. Welcome to Robots.
Hi, Adam. Thanks.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. Well, I've been interested in AI for a long time, probably since I was about 12 years old and started to draw robots and envisioning the future. And I thought that the predictions, you know, would make it so, you know, would all come true and make it so that by the time I was grown up, you know, there would be robots everywhere. It seemed pretty obvious to me. And the truth, of course, is very different. This was in the 70s, so, you know, We haven't really seen the future come true as we thought with regards to robots and AI. And in fact, you know, part of it is actually great for me because I really love this field, and it gives me a chance to actually make some of these things happen that I always thought were exciting ideas. And so I studied psychology, and I studied computer science, and I studied philosophy a little bit. And I did my PhD at the Media Lab at MIT and graduated from there in 96. And after that, I worked at various places doing research, including Lego and British Telecom. And I was in New York for a while. I founded a company there that now is in San Francisco called Radar Networks. And in 2004, I joined Reykjavik University, and I founded the AI lab here, CADIA. And I am now establishing another research institute called the Icelandic Institute for Intelligent Machines. And this lab is going to help bridge the divide between academia and industry. And its focus is on AI and simulation. And by the way, we're hiring currently. So if you're interested, please check out the website, IIIM.is.
So you're a big expert on AI. Maybe before we get started, can you tell us what is your definition of artificial intelligence? Because we've been trying to discuss what a robot is recently, actually, and it's not so obvious. So maybe what do you think is artificial intelligence?
Yeah, it's a good question. And well, I'm going to jump right in the deep end. Basically, AI people are... A lot of them are fairly frustrated by the fact that by the time, you know, a machine can do something that it couldn't do before, that only humans or animals could do, by the time the machine can do it, it doesn't seem so intelligent anymore. So they talk about this disappearing AI effect, that by the time we figure out how something that we used to call intelligence works, we don't call it intelligent anymore. An example is chess machines, chess programs, and I'm not a big fan of this disappearing AI doctrine because I think the AI community has sort of dug their own little grave there. I think it's their own fault. Basically, we have lost sight of the phenomenon of intelligence, and the community as a whole basically has accepted the view that we can work on really isolated parts of intelligence, you know, like let's say planning or natural written language, natural language parsing, and we call that intelligent because it's also evident in intelligent systems like humans. But by cutting the phenomenon of intelligence this small, I think you're really missing Obviously, you're missing the big picture, and I think intelligence has a lot to do with the big picture. And, you know, a really great example was that when I first saw the Sony robot dog, you know, this was a while back in the 90s, it suddenly dawned on me that basically because here was a very integrated system, you know, it had the movement, it had head movement, it could direct its camera in certain ways that at least... seemed sensible, although it didn't really do much, the whole thing was complete, and it gave you this feeling that, oh, there's something behind this hard metallic shell. So, you know, in my work, I try to put Humpty Dumpty together again, basically. You know, I want to figure out the deep problems in AI, you know. How does intelligence come about? How does it self-evolve? How does it organize? How is it that a complex system like the brain can produce a mind and a coherent mind, you know, and a mind for a single body that can decide then what to do with that body? I think that those are really deep and important questions that the community has sort of lost sight on.
Speaking of the community, why don't you run us down a little bit on the history of AI? I guess it started about 50 years ago, and like you said, you were growing up as a kid and there was all these great promises of robots, the Jetsons floating around with robots that do everything for us. We haven't quite reached that. Tell us maybe from your perspective, what happened in the last 50 years?
Well, I think to cut a long story short, the ideas were really great in the beginning, and I still really think that the idea that you can make a machine that does the same thing as a human mind or animal mind, i.e. grow up, learn things, adapt to its environment, etc., and you know, speak and have social interactions and so on. I still think that's a very valid, solid idea. But it's taken us a lot longer than everyone expected to sort of tease out the magic and in a way that can be put into a machine.
And why is that, do you think? Is it because we were too optimistic and it's too hard of a problem?
Well, actually, I have a somewhat an orthodox view on that. I think that basically by trying too soon to be formal and to optimize and rigorify the study of intelligence, we have sort of lost the big picture much more quickly and to a great detriment. It's sort of like saying, you know, I want to study an ecology. It's a whole network of things and phenomena and animals and trees and, you know, rivers and so on that interact. But I'm going to study the lake and the leg of one bird. And, you know, I'm going to learn how the ecology works from that. And so, you know, you get you know a lot about the leg now of this bird, this particular species, and you can say a lot about it, and you can probably infer some things about the ecology, but nobody would call that someone who is an expert in only those two things an ecologist, because it's the whole system that matters. And so, first of all, because the problem is much bigger than everyone expected, and secondly, because the approach that was taken and sort of the path that was charted early on by trying to be too rigorous and engineering oriented instead of really being sort of open-minded and more scientific about it, I think those are the main reasons, in my opinion, for where we are today. Having said that, though, I'm not sure that we would have gotten faster, much faster, in these early days by using any other methodology, because it really is a complex issue.
Recently, going along with that, you've been championing this idea of constructivist AI versus constructionist AI. Can you tell us a little bit about what this means, what these two terms mean, and where you want to go with that?
Yeah, so in the first 50 years of AI, basically, and until now, you know, almost 60 years after we say that AI started in the Dartmouth conference, we are still, and the main way of building AI systems is coding by hand. So basically, we have this most powerful machine that humanity has ever created, the concept of a computer, and we have methods for basically making the machine do various things. It can be used for answering questions. It could be used for modeling certain phenomena. Clearly, not just intelligent systems, but you know, chemistry and so on. But the major way in which we tell this machine to do things is fairly close to the hardware itself, i.e. you have, you know, one or two levels of indirection from the transistors, depending on how you count, from the transistors up to the programming languages that we use today. All of the programming is done by hand, and that's basically construction. Basically, the AI researcher or engineer is a construction worker. So we're doing now constructionist AI. And what we need to do is move beyond that. We need to start to look at systems that build systems, autonomous systems and self-organizing systems. And if we don't do that, we'll never get out of this slow snail pace that we're in. And so those are, you know, self-constructive systems. That's constructivist AI. So I think, you know, in the next decade or two, we're going to see a shift to a greater extent than before towards constructivist AI, away from constructionist AI. Not that constructionist AI will not disappear, of course, but I think the solution to greater advancement and to ultimately an understanding, a deep understanding of intelligence, needs to go through this path, this different way of thinking that I call constructivist AI. And we have this project, European FP7 project, European Union funded, called HumanOps. And HumanOps is our biggest attempt so far in creating a machine that makes a machine, i.e. we are building a virtual television host that's supposed to view, to observe two humans interacting in an interview, sort of an interview scenario, and from that learn what matters and then be able to control either body in a real interaction with a human. So through observation, basically learn how to do it.
Maybe, Chris, can you tell us a little bit more about this HumanOps project and the work that's done in your lab? What is the main goal, and how do you propose to fulfill this goal of actually of observing and learning from that?
Yeah, so basically the task is let's figure out a way to program the computer so the computer can actually do more programming by itself, i.e. the output of an AI program is typically instructions for some motors to move, or if it's a virtual character, you know, move its graphics around, or do some other smaller parts, smaller tasks like parse language or, you know, infer context and stuff like that. In our case, we want to build an algorithm or you know, a set of algorithms that can produce algorithms, that where the output is algorithms rather than instructions, you know, for movement or for something else or for parsing. So through a higher level description of a problem or a task, the system itself can figure out what's the best way to do it. You know, imagine the task of teaching a robot how to wash the dishes. Basically, in robotics and AI today, if you want a robot that washes the dishes, you sit down and you measure the plates and you figure out you model all the distances and so on in the kitchen and you put this in, you know, this is all by hand, you know, you put this into the robot and then you press run on the robot, and the robot is actually, you know, knows how to do the dishes because you programmed it to do the dishes. There is no system today, there's no robot today that you can say, hey, why don't you come on over here? You know, I know you know how to play soccer a little bit, but let me show you this thing. This is washing dishes. That's what it's called. And so, you know, you enter the system with instructions at a much higher level of abstraction. You know, this is now yet another task I want to teach you. And why don't you watch someone do the dishes and then figure out how to do it by yourself? And if you force yourself into this kind of a thinking, you realize that the methods we are using today, by and large in AI, are never going to be able to do that. Because you need to zoom out. You need to think about the bigger picture. And what we want in HumanOps is to start to develop systems that are able to figure out new tasks without destroying old tasks or without requiring a team of people to sit and code for 2 years. So this is essentially what we're aiming at, and we're coming at this issue from very many directions. For example, at Cadia, the RU AI lab, we are working with CCP, which is a game company here in Reykjavik that makes EVE Online, which is a big online virtual world. And in this world now, they are interested in introducing virtual humans into the game. So they've come to us for advice, and we have a long running project with them to explore the space of possibilities there. Not that you will see the kind of HumanOps technology anytime soon in EVE Online, but we're really, you know, getting at this problem from very many different angles.
Can you tell us a little bit actually about these angles? Because I'm interested. What you're saying is, it makes a lot of sense, but I feel like a lot of people have tried to talk about this, but have never actually come up with something that works. How do you propose to make a machine that can learn from observation and figure new things out without being expressly shown how to do it?
Right. At one end of the spectrum, we have constructionist methods. That's the closest on the horizon. We've been using constructionist methods for example, working with Honda to teach Asimo to play card games with kids. And we're using very similar constructionist AI techniques and methodologies. I have a methodology called the constructionist design methodology, CDM, that we've been employing also in EVE Online. But we need to define the next horizon, and on that horizon, just before things disappear, you have HumanOps sort of leading the way. So HumanOps is developing a constructivist methodology with all of the things in mind that I just told you about, and trying to bridge from this constructionist to the constructivist methodology. And we're taking some ideas from constructionist AI, and we've really looked long and hard at our methodology for modularization and for distributing processes and coordinating processes and so on. All of the things you need to do if you want to have a machine that can pay attention to many things at once and figure out what's most important at any point in time and so on. And we're trying to essentially take the next steps based on what we already are good at and know very much about, and go basically the next step where we know or where we believe we need to go. And that's the constructivist horizon, if you will.
Maybe let's try to finish off this interview on a positive note, because I guess AI is always a hard topic, because there's always these big expectations. And then 50 years down the road, everybody's talking about disappointment and how we haven't met the expectations. But I don't really think that's the best way to look at it. There's actually a lot that has been done in AI and has been implemented in our lives already. And there is a bright future. So can you maybe tell us the two things? First of all, where has AI impacted in our lives? Where do you think has been the biggest impact? And then maybe say, where do you see the future? Maybe not in, you know, Jetsons, 10 years down the road, we'll have robots that can do everything, but maybe a more realistic a future and maybe a bright outlook on what we might see, I guess, in the next little while.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think the view is the future is really bright for AI. Historically, we've sort of gone in phases where it's been in fashion and out of fashion and so on. Well, to me, it never was a matter of fashion. It really was about making steady progress towards a really interesting, challenging, and important goal. And that is to really be able to implement, and that's what I see AI is about, you know, to implement intelligent functions in machines so that we can improve our lives, we can improve the lives of others, and make the world a better place. And I think there's a lot of opportunity there. But, you know, as with any technology that's powerful, of course there are also challenges. And, you know, ethics is one thing, and the legal environment for autonomous machines, which is completely immature at the moment. But the future, I think, is really bright, as you said. And there's a lot of opportunities for smart people in math, philosophy, psychology, cognitive science, computer science, to come into this field and really help make progress towards this end. I mean, intelligence is not going to help us only just to do the dishes, you know. It's going to, or play soccer, you know, which might be entertaining, but it's not so useful really beyond that. It's important for helping us answer questions about the climate, about, you know, the environment, about government, and so on. And these are hugely challenging but promising fields of research and application for AI. So I would, you know, to summarize this, I think a very good platform that we're setting up now with the Icelandic Institute for Intelligent Machines, it sort of exemplifies where I think we will see things going in the future. So IIIM is basically focusing on AI and simulation. Now, here are two fields that historically kind of have been separate, but with sort of interdisciplinary research and collaboration, we want to unify these more closely together so that we can make automatic simulations of things. We can make intelligent systems simulate things in their heads, so to speak, before they do things or to answer questions and so on. And we want to tie this all to real time, because that's also been sort of an ignored part of AI and information technology, to really build a knowledge of time into these systems so that they understand what it means to give a timely answer and can react to events as they happen in the world. I think I would, you know, I really want to see AI a benefit in a broad range of fields, and some of which I've already mentioned. I think governance is a really key place where AI could really help, and simulation as well. But we've seen officials kind of being hesitant to use technology, and even information technology, which kind of seems obvious. And we need to work on that. And one trick there is to basically educate people better and educate them in these fields, which really, really is key.
Sorry, before we go on, maybe you can explain what you mean by governance, because I was just thinking if someone who's not very familiar with artificial intelligence is listening to this podcast, they might think we should let artificial intelligent beings take over our government. It sounds a little bit like Terminator to me. So
yeah,
maybe you could
exactly.
be a bit more specific.
And that, I think, you know, and that's we can blame Hollywood for that.
Of course.
Basically, because when you think about the task of governing, what does a government do? Well, if it's a government in a democratic country or society, basically they are there to make life better for the inhabitants, for those that the government serves, right? To make the lives better for the as large a majority of the people as possible, obviously. Without making life miserable for, you know, at the cost of some fraction of the population, a lot of information is needed. A government needs a lot of information. You know, a prime minister needs to understand and systems, mechanisms, and have the right information so that the facts are known. And then decisions and lawmaking is, you know, is about changing what you can and cannot do and how things should operate. And to make those decisions right, you know, a society is a complex phenomenon. And clearly, hardly any human being understands it completely in its entirety at all levels of detail, right? So anywhere you have a problem like this, where you have decisions that need to be made and you have some designs that need to be made, you know, a government doesn't only decide whether it's illegal or not to import a certain kind of battery. They also say, you know, how much should it cost for the importer, and how is it taxed, and who is allowed to take that and transport it, and so on and so on and so on. So it's about designs and decisions. And whenever you have a set of a complex system for which is being changed essentially by such decisions and designs, AI could help you do that. But only if the AI is understood, well understood, and it's smart enough to simplify the task for the government. So I think, you know, basically having machines govern our society is idiotic, frankly. We would never want a system like that. But we may want, and I strongly believe we should have, a system where machines provide us with the right information at the right time to help us make better decisions, so that when you make that change in the import tax law, you know what the implications are before you make the change. And how can we get better at doing that? Well, you can use simulations, but simulations are complicated. You need the machine to take care of some of those simulations, and you need to be able to ask the machine questions about the simulation and about the system and the mechanics, and this is basically AI.
Well, thanks, Chris. Maybe before we finish today's interview, are there any final words that you'd like to say to the AI community?
Yes, actually, I would encourage them to zoom out. I would encourage people to take on a bigger piece of the AI puzzle, because I really think that although I'm convinced that that what everyone pretty much by and large is doing in AI now is useful and can be applied and can benefit, I think the sooner we understand intelligence in toto, the better off we are.
Well, thank you very much, Chris, for being on Robots.
All right. Thanks, Adam.
I think we're really close to a good definition of a robot with Professor Wendelin Reich from Sweden. Rather than trying to analyze what he thinks is a robot, he's taken the stance of observing what society typically defines as a robot.
Hi, Wendelin. Welcome to Robots.
Hello.
Can you please present yourself to our listeners?
Yes, my name is Wendelin Reich. I'm an associate professor in social psychology at Uppsala University and at the Swedish Collegium for Advanced Study. And I'm interested in social interaction and human-robot interaction. And I'm looking especially at how both people and robots understand simple communicative signals in context, like a pointing gesture or a stop gesture, in order to coordinate an activity.
You had a really good definition of a robot. Can you please give it to us?
Yes, of course. The idea behind it is basically, as you heard, I'm not an engineer, but I'm a social psychologist, and so I probably have a little bit of a different take on this issue. Because I think if you ask people, what is a robot, you perhaps get as many answers as you ask people, because people have different things they would like to put in that definition. So I was trying to give this question a little bit of a twist and ask instead what kinds of objects are most people in a population most comfortable in calling a robot. And that is then an empirical question. Of course, I haven't done a survey or something, but I have an idea of what I think the most likely answer would be like. So my definition is a robot is an artificial, physically embodied agent tool. So that's concise, but also a bit dense, so I can walk you through that word by word. And the most important word is, of course, agent. A robot is an agent, as opposed to an object. And this distinction, agent versus object, is really basic in cognitive science and neuroscience and so, because the idea is that our brains, and actually animal brains, are automatically able to distinguish the entities in their environment into agents and objects. So, for instance, if you think of a ball that runs down a slope, then this ball is just following gravity, and if it bumps into a block or so, it doesn't have a choice and cannot avoid it. But if you think of a little animal that walks down a slope, then it can circumvent this block because it can pursue a goal. So that's the basic characteristics of agents. That's how we identify agents in our environment. We see entities that behave as if they pursue goals. So I think that would be the most basic thing I would put into the definition. When we think of robots, we think of agents, and that's why we are not comfortable calling, say, a combustion engine a robot, although it may be very complex. But an older industrial robot, which is able to move an arm around and avoid obstacles and correct errors, may actually be a robot because we can see it like an agent. So the next part of this definition is the word artificial. A robot is an artificial agent. And that's, of course, just to exclude animals and all the products of biological evolution, because otherwise we ourselves would be robots. And that's not how we use the word in everyday life. And the third term is tool. So a robot is an artificial agent tool. And that just conveys the idea that we expect a robot, which people have constructed, to fulfill some kind of function for us. The first thing that comes to mind if you think of a robot is not, let's say, 1,000 androids which we put into a spaceship and just send off to space and let them do whatever they want. But we expect robots to do something for us. They are tools for us. And of course, that can be tools in a very wide sense, not just physical manipulators, but think of Paro, the robot seal, who fulfills a function for us. It makes us happy when we interact with him. So robots are artificial agent tools. But beyond that, they're also artificial, physically embodied agent tools. And that is simply to exclude things like virtual agents. We call them bots often, but most people probably wouldn't call a virtual agent like the little thing in Microsoft Word that used to annoy everyone. We wouldn't call that a robot because we expect a robot to have actually a physical body. So that's my definition.
Would you say that artistic robots are a tool because they fulfill the function of entertaining us somehow?
Absolutely, absolutely. That is, that's a very good reason to construct a robot in the first place. And we want to be entertained by them. And if they wouldn't be able to fulfill this function, if they would bore us instead of entertaining us, then we probably wouldn't build them in the first place. So, yes, I think they are tools as well.
I'm wondering, with respect to agent, to find a good definition for the word agent, is it something which is settled right now, or is there some discussion about this?
There's a very large discussion and a large empirical literature, because you see, it's not how we define agents, but the idea is that our brains define agents for us. So infants from just a few weeks of age are able to react differently to things that behave like agents and things that just behave like objects. They are more interested. They look longer at things that behave like agents, that pursue goals. So you can find such criteria, what makes up an agent. And of course, most of these criteria are what is actually characteristic of animals. But it's really an empirical question. We do not go as cognitive scientists and say this or that is an agent, but we're interested in what rules does an observer use in order to identify a thing as an agent. And this goal pursuit and self-propelled motion and avoidance of obstacles and means-ends calculations, they're all part of that.
So mobility is a requirement in this definition?
Some kind of mobility. It doesn't have to be the mobility of the entire object. For instance, an animal like a sea animal, which lives on a rock and just moves its arms in order to catch fish or something, we would definitely be able to identify that as an agent because part of its body displays autonomous motion. And obviously this motion serves an identifiable purpose in order to get food and stuff.
Can you think of anything which some people might think of as a robot which wouldn't fit your definition?
Yes, I think what this definition excludes are very simple machines that happen to look like robots or what we've come to identify as robots. For instance, very simple humanoid toys that are not really able to do any cognition, that just have a motor and move a bit. These would not be called robots according to this definition because they actually do not display agency. They just happen to look like things we've come to expect to be agents, humans. It would also exclude very early industrial robots, which didn't really have any ability to correct for errors and to really pursue goals. They were just programmed to follow very strict movement patterns. And if these patterns couldn't be fulfilled, couldn't be carried through, the system would break down. And when you see that, you realize, oh, this is just a mechanical entity. It's just a few gears and nooks built together to create a motion pattern. But it doesn't really do anything because it wants to do anything. So that would be excluded from the definition, but I hope it's not a steep price to pay.
No, I agree that they should be excluded, actually. So thank you, Vendeline, for a very good definition.
Of course. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I personally really like this definition and would like to know if you, our listeners, are satisfied with it. Therefore, send us your personal impressions on this definition at info@robotspodcast.com, or better definitions if you happen to have any. In the meantime, we've posted a summary of the definitions we've received so far on our website. Thanks again to all our listeners for the excellent contributions, and make sure to keep the discussion going on our forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
For more information on our guests, check out our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Discover AI with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.